good productive meat. But first we have a measure of lesser importance. Is it in or yet? Okay, which comes in. All right, fine. We've got Prakash Lee Govender here from Renegade from COSATU, who's now in Lumsa. As you know, it's a democracy. People are free to flee from their original identities. I'm easy. Okay, Prakash, we know, was only part of Vinaya Parnas, basically, you know. Those who don't know, she's been in and out of Parliament, COSATU representative, and now in Lumsa. So, I must apologize to you. Actually, when we pursued it, your letter was, in fact, in the fight. Somehow I missed it last week. So I read out your letter, which was here last week. It wasn't lost. In fact, I hadn't, I'm getting older than last week, so I didn't notice it. So I read it out yesterday, over to you. You were training it, if you need that much time.
Good morning, and thank you. And thank you also for the introduction, so I thought I shouldn't say more on that part. I just also just want to apologize because we were expecting to bring leadership with us, but we got crisis in steel industry, so we were a little forced to present this one. It's not about my political backing. My first starting point, obviously, is to at least take us back into some of the context. Unfortunately, we're dealing with a bill that isn't a standalone bill, as we all know. I think we've all been into a discussion. So at least we do have to look at some part of the context and what motivates our approach to this bill. And our argument obviously first starts from a historical point of view, and this relates to the fact that institutional establishment of Provident Fund is something that was primarily black low-income workers fought for under the apartheid government, and was also to ensure that they had a measure of control in relation to their retirement savings, and that was obviously to be able to take it out of the lump sum rather than to invest it in funds that they did not trust. Further, our argument is that this is deferred wages. This is not money that belongs to anyone else but workers, so workers have a right to decide how that money is used and how they control it. In addition, and this is a call made by other organizations, we feel there needs to be a broader discussion. Any retirement reform has to be dealt with in a broader discussion around comprehensive social security, which also relates to the broader arguments on how we deal with historical legacy of poverty and inequality. And finally, we also want to look at the radical transformation of the retirement fund industry, which we feel that there's literally trillions of rands invested and with no control from workers as to how this is invested, and also in terms of the nature of investment that we would need, for example, more ethical, or whether or not they actually create jobs and those kind of things. So that would be the context historically from where we come from. In relation to the revenue laws amendment bill itself, and specifically in relation to compulsory annuitization, we know that this bill itself does not deal with compulsory annuitization, and it relates to, it's preceded by the taxation laws and amendment bills from the previous years, particularly initiated in 2013. Now, up front, we want to indicate that NIMSA is opposed to compulsory annuitization, and obviously emphasis on the compulsory aspect of it. And this is notwithstanding the fact that there has been some differentiation that's been built into law, but the 247,000 rand threshold, in terms of which, above which, the law becomes applicable. Also, in terms of the exclusion of those who are 55 years and older, and exclusion of Provident Fund contributions that are made prior to the law of operation. We feel that notwithstanding the fact that it does exclude all the contributions up until the operation of the law, that this actually segments the ability of workers to actually engage in the issue, and also the other things that this actually discriminates against younger workers, and younger workers also have the right to make decisions in relation to their retirement savings. We understand that the main purpose of the bill is to perform compulsory annuitization, as opposed to our call, which is to actually repeal it. We also understand that this bill does not postpone, which is something that we do welcome, which is the equalization of tax treatment of workers' contributions towards Provident Funds. And I know that the argument from Treasury has been that they can't argue this politically. We feel that there's discrimination against the contributions of workers contributors to Provident Funds, because eventually they're paying double, even twice the amount of tax, even if they don't claim a tax credit at the point of making monthly contributions to Provident Funds, they will still be taxed fairly heavily if they make a withdrawal before retirement age. And in fact, as we understand, if they take a lump sum as opposed to any tithing, there's additional tax implications as well. So it's not as if they aren't already other tax disincentives that are building against farmers and holders. On the question of postponement of the repeal, we think that there are some procedural issues that need to be raised. First, you know, we are uncertain as to what this means, because as I understand, compulsory annuitization is an act of law that's operational from the 1st of March. And to some extent, there would have to be some measures of compliance that we would have to be put into place by the retirement fund industry. We also create certain uncertainty. So obviously what we have is a situation as obviously you have a non-compliance, condoned non-compliance that would be effective retrospectively. We're also concerned that there have been very minimal consultation by Treasury voters and trade unions, including with NEDLAC. We obviously believe there should be beyond NEDLAC law, but there has to be consultation. These are workers' money. We're also particularly concerned that the discussions have been fragmented from the discussions on developing a policy for comprehensive social security framework, which we argue Treasury has been delaying for some time. Finally, somewhat different from other organizations, our concern also is that, and this relates to other measures in which research agencies have pushed through Parliament, is that this is, the compulsory annuitization is not a tax matter per se. It's not the imposition of taxes. It should not have been treated or followed the proceeding in terms of Section 77 and tagged as moneyable. And we feel that that's actually opened up to constitutional challenges. I mean, this wouldn't be a first bill that has actually been tagged incorrectly and has been successfully challenged in the Constitutional Court. And on that basis, we are considering our legal options to how we will proceed in terms of our main response legally as far as the 2013 laws that have been put into place. We also want to just deal with something which also underpins this law, which is the question of a core savings charter. And, you know, linked to this is Treasury's argument that they consider that they want to reduce lines on the state social assistance. We think, you know, we would also like to do that by case decent work. And I think that would also, you know, increase tax revenues and have a great penalty there. But our argument is that, yes, there is a core savings there, but it's got nothing to do with culture at all. South Africa is not different from any other country globally with lower income earners. We actually have lower savings, and essentially because we find that proportionately households with lower income spend more on consumption. We also have a problem where we have the banking system and financial sector as a whole has marginalized lower income workers. Not too recently, we've had a failed attempt as far as domestic workers was to actually establish a special retirement fund model for domestic workers, and obviously that would have been laid the basis for other lower income workers on that scale. It shows you that the retirement fund industry and financial sector is not friendly to low income workers and also undermines the issue of savings. And then finally, I think this is an argument that we're all familiar with. There are stock sales and example stock sales and burial societies which actually reflect that low income workers and households actually do respect the culture of savings, but have had to find their own alternative ways to deal with this because of a financial system and the economic system that forces them out. So the next slide that I want to deal with, I've actually handed out a larger copy because I think the one in the pack is actually not legible. So I think it's important for us to actually contextualize what we deal with, because I think if we look at pension fund assets, it actually speaks to generally South Africa is the most unequal country in the world, but also speaks to how it actually relates to pension fund assets. If you look at the table that I've handed out, these are not NUSA tables, these are from the OECD data. The first table just details pension fund assets as a percentage of GDP for OECD countries. And the second one has a percentage of pension fund assets in relation to GDP for non-OECD. So South Africa is reflected in the second group. If you look at the OECD group, and it's quite important, you will find that South Africa will probably find itself somewhere just below the United Kingdom. In fact, it's not just relatively large, it's massively large. It would fall into, you know, the kind of relatively average saving that would be to a very wealthy industrialized country. It is the largest, pension funds relative to GDP is actually the largest non-OECD countries, and you find there's a big gap between themselves and the bulk of the non-developing countries, and that is as well. When we take that particular fact and say that we can see that there is huge assets, but also been weighed up against the fact that, yes, factually, the majority of people in this country will not be covered either adequately or enough by pension funds. And you can see that there is a reflection or trajectory of a huge inequality. After an unsolved question of what we need to do with comprehensive social security, it's not so much only about workers just having control and being able to serve their rights around return funds, because the need for broader comprehensive social security discussion to link up the retirement is to understand how we can actually equalize access and protection for retirement, and also before retirement and during retirement, and in a way that provides a sustainable decent income. Now that discussion hasn't been had, and we cannot be held in a fragmented way. The other issue that we also raise is also in terms of socioeconomic data is that you highlight, if you look at the current dynamics in terms of our apartheid labor market, we, as I mentioned before, we're just unable to push workers to save at the levels in which we would prefer, so to be able to provide them with a sustainable income at retirement. So essentially, the economic system is what has driven them out of the system. And we also note that, you know, in spite of arguments pushed by, for example, the Reserve Bank, Treasury, the free market foundations, globally and locally, you'll see that trends reflect that labor's share of income, national income, is on the decline and has been declined for a long time. And this as both, you know, as opposed to the argument that, and this is an ideologically driven argument, that wages constitute a major cost driving in the economy. In fact, we find that data is questionable, and also data has been developed in many industrialized countries where they have fuller employment and better quality of employment as well. In fact, in a country where there's a high degree of informal employment and where you have basic coverage of a collective bargaining, it just doesn't, there's no relationship as wages being a bus driver. So we also find the contradiction in that argument where you have Treasury trying to push policies that drive down wages, but at the same time expecting workers to save more. The argument, in order for you to save more, you have to earn more, and we have to deal with the upper-party wage gap. The other contradiction, and this relates to and the broader discussion on the reforms that are required in relation to the retirement fund industry, and also more generally in relation to financial capital, is that there's already lots of data now being South Africa reflecting being one of the leading countries in terms of both illegal and as well as legal but controlled capital flight and financial flows. So on the one hand, you have Treasury that has lifted financial regulations to enable that to happen. And on the other hand, you have a system where they're trying to entrench a system where it actually locks workers' funds into retirement funds in a way that they are unable to access as nonsense. Moving on to the question of comprehensive social security, I think it's actually important to note that upfront, NUMSA is actually concerned about the interests of workers both during, before and after retirement, and we do not feel that there's one even more important than the other. The quandary that you find that most workers find themselves is that retirement funds are now being used to plug gaps in the comprehensive social security net and required to fulfill other gaps that are not even related to retirement. But if you're fixed with retention, you have no choice but to decide on a save for later but stop now. And that is a very difficult choice for them to make. The other issue is that the annuitization, which is not being raised directly, but which is pushed forward implicitly and which is indirect, is that the annuitization from our calculations will not provide a decent income. So often you'll find that workers want to withdraw the lump sum, not so that they would spend it in a spendthrift way, but in order to look at ways of alternative income generation, which they can only do using a lump sum amount. So accordingly, yeah, we would argue for there being more holistic and redistributive way of approaching the process. We'd also want to look at how we deal with those workers who are probably not in the foreseeable future going to be able to contribute to the retirement fund industry in the same way as workers in better positions, for example, domestic workers and seasonal workers. We need to deal with how we can provide them with a decent income. Okay, in conclusion, and I hope that it's been clear that we've raised both procedural and substantive concerns. We are maintaining our argument that in this process, that the committee should rather repeal those clauses rather than postpone them. And we maintain a call. We will also be pursuing our call through other processes. We currently have a Section 7 process called NEDLAC, which enables us, if the process, to go for this action, and we will also assess thereafter our legal options as well, whether or not we challenge the compulsion and interrogation on a constitutional basis. Thank you.
Okay, Christian Verst.
To adjust the point of clarity from the economic I just want to find out if she is aware whether the kind of savings culture that she is talking about is largely consumption. People are generally saving only to spend that money on buying food end of the year. And I'm not sure if that aspect has been taken into account. But secondly, I also wanted you to probably speak into issues of, you know, somehow I'm not sure if your first, is it the first, it's the biggest slide. I'm not sure if your slide today is not contradicting itself. You know, the one that you said, like, in the midst of a quarterly culture. I'm not sure if you are not contradicting yourself, because on one hand, you are talking about poor level of savings is not cultural. And you go further into saying it reflects, you know, the percent of poor household income, a different greater proportion of income on consumption than saving. I'm not sure if you are not contradicting yourself there. Maybe you will clarify that to me. And the other issue that I think maybe you may help us to address is because I actually do feel this light of water that I generally sympathize with the light of water. But on the other hand, the concern that I have is that if we keep on discouraging workers from, you know, maybe if we keep on discouraging them from really getting into the space where they really save for the future and not just for something that is instant, because I know that generally, either the things that we have are savings around funeral, and my view is that I don't think that it's a good kind of savings. Yes, we want to be our relatives with honor in part of you, but what benefits does it bring to those that remain behind in terms of improving their quality of life? Now, that aspect I do have a challenge with. The other issue that I also wanted you to speak on is that in Numfa's group, how competitive is our labor market in South Africa compared, not just, I'm not talking about the world, I'm talking about the continent as such. And I'll tell you why I'm asking you that question. I happen to have met a guy from Japan, and we're talking about, you know, opening another plant somewhere in Africa where I cannot mention. And part of the reason why they were worried about South Africa was that their own experience with South Africa is that if you invest in South Africa, you will find that workers are demanding higher wages, which is fine, but that is not matched with productivity, and that creates uncompetitive labor environment. Now, I want to know, Ubuti, how are we addressing those issues? Because if we keep on denying that reality that is out there, then we're going to end up with workers that think, you know, it's good enough to save. And I'm going to tell you, my view is that to save, you have to talk. Somehow, sometimes you have to, it's got some time, it's got to be imposed on you. I'm talking from my own experience, like from my mother, would be imposing that to me, to say, you've got to say, you're not going to be getting this, you know. And the reality is that we've got to start confronting that. I am saying that because it's largely the black African working class that is affected by this. And if we keep on pushing the goalposts, I'm not sure where we are heading to. But I would welcome your comments. Maybe you have a reasonable explanation for that. I don't know. But these are issues that kind of trouble me all the time. Thank you.
Pinky, for you.
Thank you, Chair. Chairperson, mine is a general comment, and I think Shadari and Nomsa and or Kosati maybe can be able to assist me in this discussion. And it's a very practical one. If you look at the intention of this act on annuitization, and Momo, I'm speaking under correction. The public service in terms of this act is not necessarily affected. Because currently as we speak, this has been what has been happening in the public service. And I can tell you, which I sit here, a teacher who took pension 10 years ago still is able to survive through the system of government on how to access monthly his or her own pension. Now, and I can also share my own experience, and this is what I want to challenge you on. That 10 years ago, Western Deep Levels, as an example, my uncle was working there. They were laid off. They were given their money, and today he's queuing at social development precisely because there's no means to survive. Now, my issue changed that. Yes, there may be challenges on, and especially on the Providence Fund constituency. What is it that there are challenges, what is it that can be done to assist in this regard? But the trend is, I'm not getting it from news, as you say. We can proudly stand on top of this roof and say, all our Provident Fund people who took their money 10 years ago are proudly surviving even today, and they are not a burden to the state. Have we done that survey? At NUMSA, at COSATU, and all other, because the majority of your constituency are Provident Fund people. Because we should not be short-sighted when we deal with this thing. We must look at the reality. I'm sitting with my uncle, he's a burden on me, and he's a burden on the state. Yet he had an opportunity to use that money sparingly and make himself survive. Now the challenge is, if we don't look into the things going forward, we are also going to say to government, there must be a legislation that also says, if you have been a government employee and you ate all your money, you used it up, you can't come back and queue for social development. Because you can't have, somewhere the buck must stop. Somewhere the buck must stop. I mean, this tab that we are opening, it can't be open forever and ever. I mean, so let's be realistic and find each other and be practical. Where are the people who were laid off, who were given those pensions? Are they still surviving today with that money? I can tell you to be 1% if they're still there. Thank you.
Forgive me.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. And may I start off by saying, Chairperson, I noted when you actually introduced
Prakashi.
By stating that, you know, she was from this place and then just moved to that place. You know, the person, the fun of it, the fun of it, is that, you know, if you charge, it's turned against you. It becomes quite soft. But if the charge is turned against you for a reason, I think you need to look at it. But you can always call the charge to the side and there are just messages with the charge. So, Prakashi, you talk to your mother and father every once in a while. That was the feeling that the chairperson is going to be in that. Secondly, chairperson, on the culture of failing, which was addressed, I think the person we need to be realistic and say that yes, the culture of failing is a culture that's got to be inculcated into all our people. But I must say that from the African side, especially black people or black like me people, we always had these domestic workers, our mothers were domestic workers, we had all these stoppers. That is how many of us were educated. I think even my brother just sitting across me there, he knows what I'm talking about. When it comes to being educated by our mothers who were involved in stoppers, during that time, even the banks were not even willing to even give our mothers an ear so that they could save. So that they could put their money there. So the money were also put in trunks under the beds and everywhere else. But they knew, our mothers, that they needed to educate their children and do whatever. So it means that the culture had already started. Because many black people are educated through those money, which were put under beds, under those little trunks, with a little key and everything else. And everybody knew that underneath that bed, with that trunk, there is money, and that money is kept there because it cannot be taken anywhere else. Yes, we definitely do encourage this culture of savings, which is nothing new to us as a black people. And then banks later, the person realized that they had missed out on the greatest potential ever in South Africa, and that was when they started bringing in the stock firms, opening up banking books and doing everything else. So it's not really something that is new. Many of us were educated through that. But then through NUMSA, and that is the I'm sorry to use this word, but that's the only word I can think about. That is a child that is turned away from the mother body. From your slide, this is postponement, this is repeal. Like I'm saying, you were doing it for your own reasons. You know why you did it. It's quite important for one to realize that there are bodies or structures where you need to take this matter to, like DEC, like all the other bodies. We would be interested as a committee to hear or get an input on the type of final decade or proposals. We do note some of them which are noted here, where you'd be taking them to NEDLAC and everywhere else, but we'd like you to take the interest of workers at heart as you take the matters forward. The matter here of the absence of the comprehensive social security, when one looks at this comprehensive social security, it means that we need to take into consideration some of the facts or some of the points which were brought about by Honorable Dinky here. We do have many of our people who were given their pensions as it was 10, very, very small amounts, which one could not even live with for 3 months. And they were expected to go on living with that for as long as they lived. Some actually died because they were so poverty stricken they couldn't do anything. What type of proposal is now that you are NUMSA, away from the other structure, will you take forward to ensure that the actual interest of the country is at heart? So that our people, because it's years and years they've been negotiating with NEDLAC and everything else whilst we're still in the other structure. But then one would say to you, now that you are the other structure, now that you're NUMSA, how are you going to do this differently? Because you have done it so many years and it hasn't really worked. We've had many people leaving your mining sector and everything else who've been very good and loyal in their deductions every month to yourself. But once they leave and they go home, they become poverty stricken. In the end, they spend that money, as Honorable Pinky has stated, then they become poverty stricken and then they end up in those substances and then they need some money for living. How are you actually going to make a difference? Because you knew about it many years back. And lastly, Chairperson,
the very last line which Nunsa spoke about is that the very last point here is that Nunsa will pursue this call by law in Parliament. I think that's what they are doing with ourselves and through other processes that he may lack. And then I think you also said, Madam, that you would also be going to the streets and doing everything else. How is that going to be done in such a way that it does not affect the economy of the country, especially going to the streets, especially the much more, fighting and going out into the streets and all that? Because right now, we need to start up everything that we do in such a way that we do not hurt the economy of the country, because once we have the economy of the country, it has the respect of hurting each and every other person. Thank you.
Okay, very quickly, one is, are you saying no to compulsory annuitization, but you find workers choose to annuitize? Do you want workers to have the option? Or are you saying no, in principle, no size of annuitization altogether? Secondly, what are your views on annuitization? Surely, as a trade union, military trade union, isn't it? You're also interested in the long-term interests of workers. Now, not every worker is so hard-pressed that they need to take their entire lump sum. And even those who earn too little and are too over-indebted need to have, in fact, more for them than middle-class backers like me. There is a stress to save. Because, you know, it's interesting. The argument on the one hand is, if you have very little, you can't save. It is also perhaps true to say it's precisely because you're little that you have saved as little as it is. It's also about what members have said, it's a transfer to the culture. You know, if you look at your own background or mine, but like matter, there may be all sorts of criticisms about the role of Indians in the economy that came in and so on. Some of it is legitimate. But there also has to be a little sense that there's a culture of saving. In the community, we can't explain. I'm a sociologist. I've been studying all these things 25 years ago when I was teaching at a university. But why certain communities are more like Lebanese in West Africa, Indians in Fiji and South Africa, and also in Africa, East Africa, some communities that have actually have a greater it's linked to patterns of industrialization. It's not biological. But it's cultural, right? So if you look at Chinese people, so on the defense state, they are cultural things. And I think what members are hinting at is even the worker in UNSA not earning a good salary needs to save one cent. It's a savings culture. So the 7-year-old, a 7-year-old boy going to school, acquires that. It's not something you can, like, sort of wait for workers to have new salaries or for socialism to come in your head. It's something you need to encourage now. Even if it's easy, if the child is given 5 cents to go and spend in school and save half a cent, doesn't matter if it's half a cent, tomorrow that child, as my mother says, my mother has a lot of pressure on her. I'm thinking about myself also. It's my mother actually. My mother says, I'll give you 2 cents, but you don't spend the whole 2 cents. So, it's not biological about me saving more. It's cultural, it's sociological, it's social, it's structural, actually. What I'm saying in short is, no matter what your views are, I think all trade unions need to encourage a sense of saving in the interest of the working class itself. The other point I want to raise with you is, look, you know, Treasury insists on this, that if you forego annuitization and the harmonization of the pension and private and fund components of the finance, you're not going to get a tax deduction for workers. But so presumably you'll find a formula. It's not going to happen. You see, the reverse side of the coin, they argue, I'm not taking an expert profession. I mean, we do look at these things also in a more technical way. But you see, the argument also is that there are a lot of people who are using the loophole at the moment. That earning good salaries, they can explain to you, who actually enter into provident funds and avoid certain type obligations. So in other words, if we leave things as they are and not have annuitization, then what you're going to have is certain people are, and these are your class enemies, if you like.
they're going to actually benefit enormously, right? I mean, Momo and others explained it, they can do so better. Now, you see, this is interesting. You're saying that South Africa's saving is not substantially different from other low-income countries, but I thought, all along, experts in newspapers, rather than means business, and which are very mad, by the way, I need to correct that thing. I did say those things yesterday, but I was feeling irritation. The people are being very sympathetic to the VDD people, and I said, how? Who are these people? They're not doing this because they changed their heart and they're suddenly patriotic and they love the country, and what they're doing is because, frankly, they're in trouble come this year. And then I didn't expect Linda, all the things, she never even comments on anything useful I say. Now it becomes an issue. I said they're all, I did say that, now I have to go and correct that because it's going to frighten people. They should all be in jail. So can I put that on record? Linda's not, you should ban Linda from this meeting. I was going to ban her, I just say. But I didn't mean to say it like that. Whatever I think personally, that committee feels that we must encourage these people, errant as they be, that's the most I will say, errant as they be, to bring their money back. It's our money, it's the country's money, so I need to break that somehow. Leave that aside for now. What I'm saying is that until now, the Business Day commentators and other business reports, they were saying they have a low saving culture by the standard of comparable countries in a middle income developing country. So this is news to me. I don't know if Tracy's got anything constant. On your thing about tagging, look, I'm no expert, but I've been around a long time. I think you're on very weak ground today. Really. But hey, if you're right to go to the United Nations, where you are not, International Labour Organization, WTO, they're explaining all of that this morning. You know, going to Al Jazeera, complainers, having gone around for the air and so on. Now, the thing is, what I'm saying about Tracy is, I think, Jacob, you reply, you're the advocate on our side, and then the frequent advocate, Mormon United, who was supposed to reply on the tagging issue. We did discuss yesterday, but now we would like to show you what he learned yesterday. The other things I'll leave. I also want to suggest, look, this is my own view. I'm not saying the majority will agree with it, but I have gone on the record. I thought we more or less we agree to some or other extent. That you see, there are people who say the reason we don't like this organization is because it's rescuing the government from its welfare responsibility to the poor and disadvantaged. That actually, you know what, it's this old sort of manual story about we can't continue to be a nanny state, right? So there are times when I know some of the unions feel, you see, the government now wants to reduce the welfare aspect of the state. So, you know, they want our workers to pay the burden of that instead of introducing higher taxes. Now, I don't know where surgery, first and surgery think that, but it's a highly credible argument to say, you know what, the state must continue in a society of such huge inequalities and high unemployment to play its part. All of us, I would imagine, in some or other degree, know it's unsustainable. We don't come a 9% growth rate projected for this year, with investment, you know, trickling down, trickling out. The prospect of the state being able to provide is limited. But on the other hand, I don't think one should argue, my view, that, you know, we must have an annualization primarily because the state must be risked from its responsibility, not as unsustainable as in long term. So I would prefer that you see the corporate don't necessarily agree with that, but we still hold the view that some form of annualization is something that in the longer term is worth it. You see, on the issue of over-indebtedness and so on, no, it's not because we said it, but I think we should be excruciatingly aware. Excruciatingly aware of how strong people feel, how strong emotional that. Even people on pension funds, teachers, literate people, with master's degrees and postgraduate diplomas in teaching. Let me tell you, I was in Nambiki Lake, right, this weekend. This is a teacher, you're wrong, of course. Killing me a hard time. Then I tell her, you're not affected at all, Lucy. You're not affected. So I would choose to say, but you, wow. For the next 45 minutes, I'm going to go, it's hot, and I'm on the road for the whole day, and I sat there for an extra 45 minutes doing this job, you're the same person. They were shocked. So people are saying to me, but Eunice, I thought I'm also affected. They're all getting affected. Sorry? What I'm saying is, you know what? I mean, you know what? You can have your views, but hey, I'm not convinced by a lot of things you say. Really, Prakashmi. We understand. Obviously, you represent the working class.
directly contact with us. But hey, you know, all of us know how strongly people feel about it. But it's really, we're going to handle this thing in a measured way. And you know what? You'll go on your strike whatever we do here. We're not naive. We also know we're not naive. It's about, it's not just about the issue or the merits or the demerits of the bill before us. It's about reflecting your political muscle. You want to form a new federation. You've got to ask for exam. They try to flex the muscle too. She doesn't exactly have a communist. But you know what? We are being made here as footballs between all of you, fighting for membership. But on the longer term, also think about it. What is in the objective long-term interest of the workers? In some form or another, Prakashi, even if Ivan Zuma was president tomorrow, you think you guys are going to be able to say, oh, no, 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 you know what? The state will deliver. So we'll have to find some compromises between the positions you hold and the positions Treasury holds. And we are urging COSATU to grudgingly, and we're dragging them by the scruff and saying, strike a deal, the in-between. Right? But they too, you see, the more militant you are, the more militant they have to be. And the more militant they are, the more militant you have to be. So this is a fight for membership thing, at all costs. You have to flex your muscle, you don't see any federation in the first place. Right? You really have to outdo them, you battle with food and canning on your side, other unions are not coming, you need to be seen to be more militant. So it can be suggested that, hey, is it about the specific merits of this bill, or is it about ensuring that you exceed the membership and the political weight of COSATU. So, you don't have to answer those questions, but you brought this upon yourself. Right, over to you, Advocate Jenkins, before we allow Advocate Mormon to respond.
Thank you, Chairperson. For me, there are two ways where we looked at the tagging mechanism. The first way is when the bill comes to our office, we advise the joint tagging mechanism on it. And look at the court cases that have been given to us, not on section 77, but on 75 and 76, of these other procedures of constitution. And the Constitutional Court made it very clear, look at the purpose and effect of the legislation to an extent, but that, you know, we're actually looking at what the impact of this legislation, what is the real impact it's going to have when we're doing tag or a classification. As I said, we haven't dealt with 77 in the course, but when we look at this bill, it changes the definitions. First and foremost, in the tax income tax act, so that we get an extension or a delay of the annuitization of government funds. Secondly, it amends certain sections in the tax taxation laws amendment act of 2015. But here, when I look at, I've just gone through it again. When I look at the effect of those clauses, it affects the way we calculate what can be deducted from tax and how we determine that. So therefore, when I wrote the classification to the JTM, I advised that it's a 77 book. The other way that we can approach this question is just simply ask, would it be okay for this committee to introduce a bill like this in terms of the Constitution? Anyone says yes, then it can't be a money bill.
Mm.
Because a money bill can only be introduced by the Minister of Finance.
Mm. Mm.
And there again, I don't think it's the purpose of the Constitution to say that Parliament can introduce legislation like that, that will have a fiscal impact. Or even a financial impact, even if it's not so big as fiscal. And I think that, for me, that both point to 77. It's not a, it can be a highly technical exercise, it's not supposed to be a highly technical exercise, according to what the courts have said. Also, in comparative jurisdictions we looked at through the years. And as you said, Jay, this is not the first time we're dealing with this. We've struggled with this, we've worked on this through the years, the 15 years I've been in Parliament. And courts have said, that sometimes a very grey area, but you have to look at the impact of this. Thanks, sir.
But can I just ask you, is it also relevant to say that actually the bill, you remember for country, I think you were still around then, maybe you were there. 2013 has passed, right? It's actually an amendment of section 76 tagging, right? Secondly, you're also extending tax provisions here to those on provident funds who until now have been excluded from the tax deduction. So again, it's a money bill in section 77. So we are a bit amused, actually, about why bullies are out. But you're right. But the moment you want to reply to anything, before we hand over to Prakashi, but before you do, let's just get in quickly.
Sure. Before Momo and the presenter respond, there's one thing that I've identified in the letter to the chairperson, also as she was to the case. that one of or the major or serious concern that they are having is lack of transmission. I think when we were addressing the public hearing last week and several times, we were talking about this lack of consultation, and this is what is going to the public. What is the understanding of NUMTRA in as far as consultation is concerned? And I think Treasury can also clarify that, because the public is getting information or is informed that the Treasury or government is not consulting us, and eventually they are deciding on the bid. But we need to clarify that, and what do they understand about consultation? Because consultation, you can agree and not agree, but you've consulted the engagement. So Treasury can also assist in terms of
Just to also add that,
what we did is we can send you a copy of it. We dealt with our line as Parliament. We don't know what we did to actually do it. What more could we have done apart from what we did? But on the issue of treasury consulting, they came with a list of meetings they had in Nederland primarily. And we said, okay, you had these meetings. We can see you had meetings, but as to the quality of the meetings, did the negotiations take place in Lincoln? We can't comment on who went there. Now, as I understand it, colleagues, you have to remember, if I understand it correctly, you're not part of NEDLAC, right? Because NEDLAC only includes trade union federations. So, the Treasury has to engage with you outside the NEDLAC process. we should separate two things. What Parliament do, they're so wrong. We just did what we normally do, and they're probably, as you know, I don't know if you know about this committee, but the committees you might have been pleased with, which I said, we have public transportation to the home board and the boat. So, I don't know what more we could have done. But as far as the executive goes, Treasury have alerted them to this. They need to consult more meaningfully, not just nominally. And they've committed themselves to it. So, in fact, they're a bit shaken, I think, what's happened over this bill. But they've learned their lesson. So, on consultation, I agree with people. I'm not sure what he's supposed to do beyond what he did. How does that over to you a moment? We've got to move on, please.
Yeah, Chair, very quickly, I think on the trading at the Jenkins that dealt with the issues, but in fact, if NUSA does open this up, like you said, we're not preventing people from annuitizing or not annuitizing if there's no tax deduction. But if there's a tax deduction, then it needs to be in the textbook. Just like when you have the auto plan, the incentive.
Yeah.
The employment tax, whatever incentive, of which NUMSA is a big beneficiary, I would like to see whether they use the same arguments when it comes to those issues as well. I think with regard to the second point, you never argue. NUMSA likes to paint people in a corner. If you argue like that, that's fine. But certainly, we've never argued that annuitization must be done to prevent people coming to the state. Obviously, the issue is this. What the state gives you is very little. As a worker, you earn. If you are only going to be reliant on what the state gives you, it's going to be very little. It's what's called replacement income. In fact, if you look at our issue last year when we said we are looking at removing the means test for the old age grant, or at least for those who are annuitized, so you don't have a perverse incentive. But those who say don't qualify for the old age grant, we actually want to extend it because its coverage is very high already, but to remove the perverse incentives in the system. Let me say that, if you look at the Metal Workers Fund, it's one of the best funds we probably have in the country. You have both pension and poverty. And in fact, what you find is that, I forget the exact ratio, but 70% of their members are in provident funds, say 30% in pension funds. But then you find the assets are completely the other way. 70% of the assets are with pension funds, but 50% say with those in provident funds. And that's precisely because those who are there in big numbers actually cash out. So even the graphs that they provided, you must take that into account, that people have cashed out. And here's the big issue that we do want to know is, are they saying they are against annuitization, they are against also all forms of preservation, although the two are preservation before retirement. I think that's a big issue, and leadership is needed. Certainly, we had a case when NUMSA reps have argued that they don't want annuitization and we should follow the UK Conservative government. Now, we're certainly not neoconservatives, so we won't want to follow that kind of approach. But I find it interesting that those sorts of arguments have been...
Without Financial Times article, Momo?
Yes, I will circulate it now. I'll get them circulated. Thanks for reminding me. I'm getting forgetful. I think just the last point I would like to make is we'd like to engage with NUMSA, and I think part of the problem, of course, is that now that they're not part of NELEC, I've been talking to the office of Mr. Jim, and for the last 3 weeks we can't get a date. Mm-hmm. He said we'll be there any time to engage on these issues, and we'd like to continue, just because we think these issues are important, and it's important that one just doesn't take an ideological position when it really affects people on the ground. And we think that just given the base that they have with funds like Moksha and so on, it would be a tragedy if people are given the wrong advice. I think it's important that we find, we converge on these issues and take into account their concerns, and going forward, how can they also come into any consultation process?
Good. Okay, we have all the other kind of great details in minutes. Sorry. Okay. If you need that.
I'm tired of the political show.
Okay, you've been extremely wise. That's why I say you come to our meetings. You don't be shy at school, right? So you don't be suspicious of her. The world has changed. They're suspicious of the ANC, but you're not suspicious of the IFP. Now the world has changed.
Chairman, the interesting word used by Fred Hashley is prodigal. Now, if I understood Sam prodigal, that means someone who's already rejected.
I just want to deal with some... I probably won't deal with the investing order, but on the question of whether it's a political exercise, I just want to state very clearly we are the ones who have to represent the majority of the workers who are affected by this. And the mandate, it comes with that mandate. So the issue, unfortunately, is primarily about the service union right now. And their mandate is somewhat shady. On the question of anti-globalization and innovation, there is no fundamental opposition to it at all. It's a compulsion nature of it. And you won't find anything anywhere that says we oppose anti-globalization as a matter of principle or precedition. There are workers who may produce better than would leave it there. So let's just put that on the thing. And on the question of ideological positions, we would argue that on both sides the ideological position eventually is following an ideological path, not based necessarily on statistics and data. On the question of the tagging, and obviously this is a technical argument, we are differentiating between the tax credit portions and the anti-taxation compulsory taxation part. As far as tax credits are concerned, we would agree that goes into the money roll. Compulsory anti-taxation is simply said, you can't take out full lump sum, but you have to anti-tax two-thirds. It's not tax. Taxation issue, and we would look at the definitions in terms of the Section 77 of the Constitution, and that's why we would argue, for example, we've had to split goals like around UIS, around skills development, and if we had to come back on quite a compensation occupational injuries, we would have to split that goal as well. So there's a big technical argument to be made, and we feel that we've taken legal advice on this, so it's not just myself arguing this, but it's taking legal advice to the courts if we have a case for this. And obviously it's a technical issue, and you know, we've had on a different tagging issue was the Camille Lambert Act, which was declared unconstitutional in terms of the incorrectly tagged. So we think that there is a case we made. On the question of whether or not poor savings is a culture, I don't think I contradicted myself, but I think maybe I expressed it incorrectly or not so well in the slide. We're saying that people are not saying because they just don't have a culture of saving. You know, they don't know. It's just the system prevents them. And I understand the sociological arguments, but I think both things the sociology is certain economic, historical things that go with it. You know, I can't come back to just speaking personally. Some are working class background historically. But I have to say that my background is different from the vast majority of African working class people. So some parts of those things actually, it benefited us to be able to enable us to participate more formally, I would think, in the banking system than for the average working class African person in the country. On the question of whether or not we should be talking about saving and what NUMSA's role is, and I think this is where we did make an argument that we're concerned about what happens to a worker both before and after retirement. So we're not, as with any foundation, as a preservation, we're not opposed to saving. In fact, the reality is that as far as resources are concerned, we agree. There is a finite resource. We obviously would want to look through a comprehensive social model, alternative mechanism of financing that, but we understand that not everybody can just spend. But the argument is that workers are not spending because they are being lavish with their money. And I understand the anecdotal example given about the person who retired 10 years ago and not exhausted the problem. But we've got anecdotes of where people were forced to dig into their problems on lump sum because they had no choice. It was either you put food on the table or you save for retirement you'll never reach. There is that challenge, and that's where we argue that this debate becomes very difficult to be had because the retirement fund is being used to plug a gap that shouldn't be plugged, which is what we do to cast our answers. I think we need to deal with that. We would argue that the vast majority, there would be individuals who, I would think, that, like in a very poor or wealthy, it would be individuals who are irresponsible. But we think the vast majority of people who get trends actually reflect that distinction in terms of being shut out of the system, not having enough faith. Other question was...
Sorry? No, I just wanted to know. Yeah. Assumption, I just wanted to find out if an assumption that you need here is if you say... there is a high probability that you will not reach your retirement age. I'm just wanting to be clear on this one because it's what you said.
No. So we're saying
that it's never, rather than people their retirement age, you may never reach.
What I'm saying is that you're forced to use your savings for. Now, which is not, you're saying that savings, your problems on pension or retirement annuity, pension is for retirement age. Mm. But you're forced to now make the difficult choice of using it at a time when you're not retired.
Yeah.
But you're retrenched, or you're facing some other financial, or you're short time with those kinds of things, so you find that people may dip into it. And we really should be creating a system where savings are encouraged. There's no way would you find an opposition to savings. In fact, built into all our collective bargaining would be how we can increase our rights in terms of problem funds. That's got nothing to do with us not wanting to save. There's no fundamental objection to saving. In fact, the reality is that by saving and contributing in terms of, relative to heaven, and our colleagues on the left would understand this about each colleague to need a quality ability, is that we need to redistribute resources. We can't all be spending. So all the resources have to be built up and have to come from somewhere. There's no fundamental objection to savings.
But
not said that.
Oh, yeah.
We said that it can be compulsory.
People can have an option.
People have an option.
They can't be forced to any time, but they want to any time.
I think we would argue, obviously, is that based on the different economic system, more people would choose as an option at any time. But, in the extended family culture, people have spoken about that anecdotally. People understand what happens to people with retirement. It's not something that's removed from reality. There's a concept called black tax, in terms of how extended families have to bear the burden of what we would argue is the socioeconomic phenomenon that we've inherited. I don't think it was relevant, but I think actually we need to deal with it because I think it deals with a myth. And I think also the media, and maybe you can also take this point, Willis, I can also take this, it's there as well. A lot of this gets out about productivity now, and also, and maybe change you also need to take this back to something as well. For years we've had incorrect data that's been put out about labor productivity. In fact, labor productivity since the end of the party has always been increasing. And in fact, the one-year reserve bank got data that actually excluded, I think it was the financial sector, and then it went to the next year to put it, and actually it reflected it as a decline, but incorrectly so. And for years, they've been keeping this up. As far as the concerns in relation to high wages and in terms of our labor legislation, those are based on business surveys, based on employee surveys. Now, how is it that a survey that takes the opinion of the employer is seen empirical? Whereas if I, representing my member, saying that those wages are too low and exploitative, it's not seen as empirical, it's seen as being biased. We've got two parties in the same relationship. I have asked journalists who've asked me the same question, is our labour market not inflexible? And I've asked them to explain to me what it means to let them respond. They've not been able to. And I've taken them to the commission and said, well, actually, a lot of people talk about the cost of dismissals and explain which section it is. It's also been proved that the IMF and the World Bank, for example, have used incorrect data, huge institutions. And I believe that's ideologically driven as well. They've used costings in terms of dismissals that have got nothing to do with actual costings and those retrenchments. And in fact, they will use the cost of retrenchment, which we know is dismissals based on economic operations, to look at hiring and firing versus misconduct, which is very different sections. So yeah, we are struggling under the burden of a poor image that has been put out in the media, not actually driven. But yeah, that is something that obviously is our responsibility to shift. But yeah, we would argue that this is more for media driven. And also, you know, there are parties within government who also pay this as well in terms of productivity. It's even in the latest budget review around public service. And there's a way that we understand their major productivity data. So, yeah.
All right. Thanks, Prakashni. Makosi, you prompted something I've long forgotten about. I just remembered now. I'm feeling very hot at the moment. I need to phone my mother. You see, I can't remember how old I was. It must have been 6 or something. And she said to me, I saw a cat. You know, in one of these outfitters in Church Street, right, in the window. So she said, all right, save money, and you can buy this house. It was 11 bits. So I spent like over a year, Marcotti, if you're listening, I told you, you prompted this whole deep thing in my
mind. I know, you're talking about church, right?
Yeah. So listen, it's been painful. So I saved the 11 bits. So I said, Mom, I'm going to buy this thing for another school. And she said, no. Give me the 11 cents. Man, I was so upset, you know. I didn't know. Because I said, what's this thing called? And she used this thing.
Braces.
And she said, you got that. Those are your fathers, right? So. This is Nazi saving. That's Nazi saving. I got to phone my mother and get it off my chest. It's kind of teasing. It's coming out suddenly. I'm thinking about it. Hey, that's the shuffle of course. Sorry? Mon's outfit is because it won't come back to me. Okay, over now to the team. As I understood our meeting yesterday, we're aging towards bridging the gap. Countries automatically think they're waging a major class struggle against the representatives of imperialism, particularly one Islam woman. But we are reaching some sort of heading towards, right? Now, when we last met, Charles and myself, we understood that where we were going was a memorandum of understanding. Your brilliant idea, Advocate Jenkins, that what we would do is take Kosato's proposals, extract from it most, if not all, that they wanted that the clergy would agree with, and put it into an MOU. So it's got a legal meaning somewhere between a report to Parliament and the bill. But then, after further discussion, it's been decided that we put it into the report rather. But I explained on behalf of the study group, because it wasn't time to meet last night, that look, there has to be an amendment to the bill, and it has to meet the requirements. And the minister and the DG, a really acting DG, Kosatu and the two chairs have been working on this since last night, and as I understand it, maybe we should start with Treasury, maybe start with Andrew Jenkins representing Parliament, the Treasury then Kosatu. On where we are, and then take it from there. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. The proposal that we want to bring to the committee to bridge this gap, as you say, is just to deal with the area of consultation, leading up to the coming into effect of provisions of annuitization. You will remember what the committee did last year
was after Richard, well, immunization will start 1 March 2016. Let's at least then have a review of those provisions, the impact of those provisions, within 2 years to see whether the fears of vote labour industry materialise or not. So the issues are a bit perverse now, seeing that we want to delay the coming into effect. So what we do is to change that clause that is in the 2050 Taxation Laws Amendment Act, just to say, instead of having a review of it, to have a consultative process prior to it, with a specific date in which the Minister will then report to the National Assembly or Parliament, so that we, as a committee, then can have an oversight over the process prior to the annexation kicking in 2018. So I think we put an exact date of August 2017 for the Minister to come and report. Also to get to the point of certainty which the industry has pointed out, and we thought we're striking a balance with that. The text of the proposed amendment, Chair, I think it's on Chris's computer. I don't know if we can have it on the screen or something. If it's not possible, we need to try and cut it out so that we can see what we're talking about. But we finalize that just before we cancel the committee, so we put short time to get a print of it. But
again, to print it, I mean,
yes,
it's a little bit confident. Olivia Ralph, what did you get?
I'm sorry to take it back. I remember last week during our public hearing when we had a seated woman who came to us for the national.
Yes.
And it's because of the compensation issue. And I've asked the question, I don't know if I somehow in the answer is here, but I didn't hear any conversation about it. Because this is what, this is the perception out there in the public that there's no compensation. So if it comes to us as a committee, we leave it to Treasury and then to deal with it and not attend it to it, it's going to give us a problem. So I just wanted to know about then what is the understanding of consultation? What do they mean? Because it's also there today, according to the consultation.
I think our issue with consultation actually involves the entire process and also the complexity of the process, because it's not very easy, not a simple bill to analyze, and it has to, in fact, consultation would involve a whole team beyond myself, people who are more skilled in return fund issues. So it involves, at that inception stage, obviously with the department, Treasury specifically, and obviously with the relevant people in the industry, each one, including obviously in principle at NABLAC. Well, historically, we were involved, included through our representation of consultation, but we would insist that ourselves and obviously other partner unions have to be consulted in a separate process because we represent two bigger constituencies to wait on the parliament. And they are being in the process, obviously, for that consultation to happen. It doesn't have to happen at NABLAC. Obviously, we would, that consultation, any consultation that has come from us in the department process, we feel has a phenomenal effect in terms of our major process because we're informed. The department comes here with its report in terms of the consultation, and then obviously the more constrained process than the consultation around the table and in terms of the treasury process. So yes, we would look forward to other proposals in terms of as you indicated, do you want to actually deal with that issue both here and as well as the instructions we've given to the executive. But yeah, we our consultation information is high process.
Thank you very much, Professor. I think the matter of consultation, Honourable Dugale is bringing it up for the second time. It's quite a serious matter, Chairperson. Can I make a request to you, Chair, to Nomsa, that they actually write down the response so that it's legal and then sent to the Chairperson in writing and then can be given to us members? We do take note of the input which has been given now, but we need the detailed information on the matter in writing, on this matter of why there is a matter of consultation and exactly what do they mean on it. Thank you.
Can I ask though, I mean, there's two separate processes. the one is consultation with the executive, with the department, and the other is with Parliament. On the Parliament side, we have also issued a statement. So really, there's nothing for us to do beyond that. We can say, I'll send you a copy. On your problems with consultation with the executive of National Treasury, you please write to us. On the parliamentary other one, you're supposed to read exactly what we meant.
Yeah.
And we issued a statement to that. Either wasn't there, and you give us a copy to us. Okay. Over to you then, Teddy. Can you explain, I'm sorry, Advocate Jenkins, yeah.
Well, here it is on the screen, right? Test really quickly.
Please. So the technical part of this is we have to look, of course, at the bill in front of us. Oh. But in front of us on page 7, as it's clause 3, that's the clause that we're dealing with.
Yes.
So just to focus members on that. And we want to now effect an amendment to that clause, which will have the effect of amending the 2015 Act.
Can we actually add it to clause 1, at the end of clause 1, I would imagine where it would go.
It's page 7, Chairperson, clause 3.
Ah, here we are.
I mean, the way we've worded it, I think at the moment it would go at the end of clause 1, if that's fine, but it's just as the same.
That's fine. So, if you look at what's on the screen at the moment, you look at clause 3, subclause 1C. 1C says it deletes subsection 8 of section 3 of the 2015 Act. But first of all, we propose to take that away.
Oh.
We're not going to just plainly delete it. We want to substitute it with a new clause. And the new clause wording is on the other one, if we go to that, because I think what the discussion between Christian is, where is the appropriate place to put the clause, I think that's a technical matter. We don't have to get too excited about that. But that is the wording of it. What it says in A, first of all, there shall be deliberations with interested parties. And then B says what would those deliberations include. It's not a closed list. And it will be as it lacks. But as I say, it's not a closed list for NIMSA, so it includes stakeholders outside NEDLAC that wants to make separate submissions. And the Minister needs to report that in terms of sub C by no later than 31 August 2017. So that would feed basically into the preparation for the budget for the next financial year when this compulsory retirement annuitization of provident funds will kick in, which should, according to my colleagues, says it would be sufficient time to deal with it. If it should be suspended, or if it should not be implemented, or if it should be implemented, are there specific conditions under which it should be implemented? That will, of course, depend on the deliberations from now until August 2017.
Chair, this is obviously premised on the fact that because we also worked on the underlying, I don't want to call it an MOU because I think that the consensus is that there shouldn't be, certainly from the other side, not from TVO, but an MOU, but that the other parties may not want to sign into an MOU, but I understand they prefer is that it be put in the report. So it then explains the underlying timelines and so on and what we mean. And I would really hope too that NUMSA and other parties out of NASDAQ are also happy with this model. So basically what we say is that the social reform paper will be released by the end of June, roughly. Okay, that's what the executive committee is doing. That obviously it will include both the package of social security measures that government puts forward and the retirement reforms. And of course that will include issues that the committee raised, like the annuitization and of preservation. That we're hoping that we don't see one agreement come out of NEDLAC or any of these processes, that some things will be more urgent than others, like the retirement reforms, and that the first report on a consultation come out sometime end of December, but we say 15th December, because as we know, we don't work after the 15th, from the 1st or 2nd of January. So that I think the first report is available from NEDLAC on progress made. That, by the way, would help because it could also be incorporated into the budget for next year. So if we have a first deadline like that, it would help. Then there would be a second deadline, which would be the end of June or middle of June next year. That would lay the basis for putting things into legislation to the extent that there's agreement. So it's still in time for the tax legislation to the extent that tax legislation is involved and non-tax legislation, and lay the basis for point C, that the minister can then has time to report to the assembly on the 31st of August. So that's based on these two reports. We felt that there should be at least a month or two for the minister then to provide any further details. So that is the underlying agreement that we, or certainly the commitment that Treasury would be very comfortable with making in this process. I don't know if Olano or Chris want to add on the process. Chair, of course, the points that are made as well as discussed with you is we do make clear that it is, if a new taxation is scrapped for problem funds, then obviously the tax deductions would cease. So it's in all our interest to get an agreement, because and although that's not in the legislation, right, this, that we don't want there to be any expectations that the tax deduction on contributions will continue, and because we don't deduct
that. Okay, that's in the report.
Right? Yeah, so that will be in the report, yeah.
Okay, Mikey?
Yeah, no, thanks, Commissioner. Yeah, look, I think it's been good for the engagements we had after the committee meeting yesterday with Peter Jenkins, Mom and the team, and I think also your telephonically. I think our side, we just basically are working towards two things. One is to amend it to the bill, which kind of requires consultation with stakeholders. And I think in fact, the flesh will come out in the parliamentary report, the inner details. I think we're fairly comfortable with the wording. We found the wording in the previous act, which provided for consultation with stakeholders. I think we're also happy to see NEDLAC also included there as well. I think we can help us, Commissioner, to have a bit of legal assurance for the engagement going forward.
I lost you there. You lost it.
You lost it.
No, right now.
Right now. Oh, no, I think for us, what was useful about the amending the bill is that it provides a legal assurance for engagement going forward. Yeah, so it's in the law. And it's clear to all parties, even at least that there's a bit of certainty and clarity. And I think it also helps us to kind of flesh out the conditional deferment, so to speak. I think, Chair, we would rather go for the second part of it, the parliamentary report, as opposed to an MOU. MOU would obviously have the unintended consequence of excluding non-dignitaries, so to speak.
I hope somebody's listening. It's proletarian solidarity.
I can't say the prodigal child, the prodigal sister. yeah, no, and I think that all the content MOU can be captured in the parliamentary report in terms of the tablings, the timeframes, the report, consultations, parameters, etc. I'm just going to finally kind of go ahead in the final wording from our NOBs today, but I'm sure I can get that. I think also the beef from our NOBs as well, also that I mean, even though it's an additional amendment to the bill, but do we still work all out to pass it by next week? I think it also helps all parties have a bit of certainty, delay, fear, etc. Then I think lastly, Comrade Chair, that maybe just to reassure our prodigal sister, that membership, I did a quick calculation now.
Yeah.
Our membership of COSATU is 50-50 for the public sector and industrial private sector. So just to adjust that list. Thanks, Commissioner.
Is it 50-50
really? Yeah, 50-50.
I thought it's 70-30.
According to the last EEC reports, it's what, 928 public servants, 931 industrial sector.
This is not audited. You'll have to find out. All right,
Asisa. Chair, it's looking very promising from our point of view, but we too are a mandated organisation, so I would need to get a mandate from members, but I am able to do that very quickly. We like the idea of the, we certainly like the idea of the a parliamentary report, and I do like the lines in the sand, the dates. I think that is the certainty, because the big concern is, as I have expressed, is that we do not
remain in uncertainty because potentially consultation processes are not going the way they should be going, and in 2 years' time, we have a mad scramble at the end and the possible repeat of this. At all costs, feel that needs to be avoided.
No, we're going to put that in my report. Actually, I'm very clear. Advocate, you worked on a draft, right?
Yes.
I should like it by 5 to 11, and then I'll work on it to put very stringent measures of checking on progress. Even though you've got your December 15 deadline and so on, we want to see how you're doing in that regard. So we'll get the first report within 3 months. And Alan invites us to there as well. So basically you're fine. It's like in the circumstances, you're not happy, but you can live with it. And you're going to be fine this evening.
Yeah, this is looking very encouraging. I'm sure the season members will be encouraged by this.
Alright. Now, what it is then that you will find consultants in the next Congress. Remember, it's in your interest, right? Because this trade union federation, the one that's constantly postponed to be formed, this never-ending postponement law of the federation, will be very relevant. You should be close to Kosaki. Find them to be strong to defeat Kosaki. Because divide and rule, that's how the Kosaki works.
Okay, Linda, nothing that's said outside of this mic, you can quote. And not everything said on this mic can be quoted either. In your absence, we beg you from these meetings, right? Because I say very profound things. Like I was talking about my mother not allowing you to buy a belt. You don't put that in the news, right? I talk about... Yeah. So, when I say I'm old and you're dodgy, that's not... Your person admits he's old and dodgy. Instead, you focus on that matter, right? But on a more serious note, I have put on record that I actually said that, and any journalist has the right to quote, and I haven't quoted out of context, so I can't even use that line. However, on reflection, I think that...
very accurate comments. I mean, they are relatively
critical. Yes, I know, but you see, you are there where you are, and I am where I am. And I actually think it is not consistent with the view of the majority in this committee, at least my own party. Yes, Linda, but I would like to just for what is good, I'll take you outside the meeting. I just want to say in your absence, I did explain that statement was said. I wasn't taking out of context. It's the right of Linda and so anybody to quote me on that. I do regret that you don't quote me on my lovely anecdotes, but it's another story I can't describe. But I do feel on reflection, it was somewhat in the chorus to only focus on that actually as a committee, and myself too personally, I feel that we should encourage people to pay up, you know, to disclose and pay. The point I should be making is not doing it for generosity at the heart or a sudden surge of patriotic fervor. They're doing it because they're vulnerable. And we must encourage them. So I would like to letter today to say, I was quoted correctly. And then my buddy, and I'll mention anecdotes you should have quoted, and then say, look, I reflect and feel that it was, I find the right word. What would you mean like within the chorus? To say it like that without stressing that it's my own view and the view of the ANC and the committee as a whole that we should encourage people. If you said that people were absolutely in jail and so on, as I did, how can I encourage people to actually come forward? Wow, Linda. You should join Nusa, Linda. Yes.
And I think the conversation which you're having with Linda. Now it's not on our agenda. Please, you can talk to her.
No, but I have to.
But then I would like to request a person. I noticed that Linda is on business day, so we will be watching what you will have written about this because it's public information, it's not made public. So we'll be watching Linda.
No, you are under surveillance.
Yeah, we'll be watching.
Even from IFP.
Yes.
But thank you all. The process now is this. Please remember. And now the DA is going to go to the Constitutional Court about this. I know that. We are, what we are doing here, can we please hear, because we need quorum, Finky, Makosi. Right? I don't run out for quorum tomorrow.
What?
Quorum tomorrow. I will try to finish the report tonight and send it to all members via Alan, right? By 10 o'clock tonight. The amendments will be given to you as well to look at the Jenkins by that time. Then what we're going to do is meet at what about the first 10 minutes and a half of members' questions? I can't meet at 10.
at 2 o'clock in G26, Alex.
When?
Tomorrow. 2 o'clock, and we finish at 10 past 2. Okay. Oh, yes?
Jim, there's no way we can agree to that, I'm afraid. It's not on. We must propose some amendments as well. So, there's no way we're going to have a 10-minute meeting.
All right, then we can a meeting longer.
And Jim, and we're not doing a plenary.
But we're not
doing a time. We will be in the plenary.
All right, that's fine. We'll check the rules. Advocate, we can still go ahead and meet. We've met before at 2 o'clock. What time do you meet at 1:30?
Jim and I already have an engagement immediately after office through to 2 o'clock. I'm afraid I'm not available, and I don't think that my colleague will be available either. And I don't know, I also wish to ask where we're going with this amendment. It's quite a significant amendment that's being proposed. What about public hearings? There are many role players who are not here, who have no idea about this amendment, who have not been given the opportunity to come and address us on the amendment. Surely there should be further public hearings?
No. We do what we do in this Parliament. We had public hearings advertised. You wrote to all the stakeholders, huh? What is all this about, Alex? You know we did all this, we reported to you. Now, we don't have public hearings again if you've made an amendment to a bill that you actually advertised for public hearings for. We, in fact, went out of our way. We wrote to, even, which is not an obligation, wrote to people who came in October last year. And, Jacob, do we have to have another public hearings now?
Chairman, let me just come in here, please. You see, this is not an amendment that has kind of come out of this committee. This is an amendment that came out of negotiations with a particular role player in this game. Even CISA wasn't involved yesterday. So you've got an amendment now coming basically a Cassata-driven amendment. That's what it is. To be clear, that is what it is. And so we're allowing as a committee Cassata to drive an amendment, and we are ignoring the other role players in the industry. And that, I'm afraid, from our point of view, is just not the right thing to be doing. Now, it may be legal, it might not be required. I have to accept that I'm certainly no expert at that. But ethically, we can't see that this is the right thing to do. And so that's why we're raising that. And then, indeed, we've got our own amendments that we want to place on, before the committee. Whenever the appropriate time comes.
No, can you never do it now? We're discussing it, we thought you'd be. We don't like it, you're going to vote against the bill. But if you've got your amendments, there we are. We've got at least another hour and 15 minutes. Can you table it?
Yeah.
We discussed the whole thing. Yeah. We put the issue before you. It's an utterly absurd set of things you say. Never before in the entire. It's utterly absurd.
It's not absurd. Please, Mr. Chairman, we.
It's utterly absurd.
No, it's not absurd.
This is a public hearing.
Yes.
Whenever
it might be your opinion that it's absurd.
No, it's a fashion. It's a legal fact. We've never done it. We have never had hearings after we had hearings when we just made an amendment. Furthermore, you have every right between now and 1 o'clock, and more if you want to propose your amendments. Where are they? No one stops you from doing so. We have many times had a single stakeholder, a CISA was invited, were you not there yesterday, Rosemary Witt, Rosemary? Were you not there yesterday?
I was not there.
Where? At the meeting yesterday? You gave us a written submission, yes?
Yes, I was at yesterday morning's meeting.
Yes.
But the negotiations afterwards, there was discussion, I think is what
the... Yeah, but what, that's the outcome, you're agreeing with the outcome, aren't you?
I'm saying that we haven't had a chance to consult with our members, but it looks encouraging.
So do you want more time? You've got more time because we've got up till... You can come back to me in time. You have another meeting now. We can have a meeting. Okay, so can we have a meeting? I will have a meeting now. The CISA, COSATU, you can join the meeting. And the chair. Do you want to join the meeting now?
Yeah, I do.
Right. So what are your amendments? Who's stopping you from proposing amendments?
No one's stopping
you.
We haven't yet got to the point where we're discussing a bill. We're talking about amendments to the bill proposed and coming out of COSATU. We will now put our amendments.
So please, let's have it.
Mr. Chairman, this bill is really, as I said already, a product of certain behind-the-scenes negotiations with a particular role. Most of the public concern, as has been expressed this morning by many, about the annuitization of the benefits payable on retirement are misinformed and false. Annuitization already applies to pension funds and retirement annuities. And you've just told this committee how you spent 45 minutes, I think it was, talking to a teacher in my hometown about that very fact. The Revenue Laws Amendment Bill will not change that. The government employee pension fund members are not affected by the 2015 Tax Laws Amendment Act. The 2015 Tax Laws Amendment Act brought provident funds in line with pension funds. If the wish is for provident funds not to be in line with pension funds, then it's a question of a tax issue. That's what it's about. And so to suggest that this is not a tax issue is not, in our opinion, a correct view. So if you're going to have the requirement to annuitize removed, even if it is for 2 years, then the tax issue must also be amended. You can't have it both ways. All contributors to retirement funds and provident funds may withdraw the entire amount due to them at any time prior to the retirement date. It is a myth that they can't do that. There may be tax implications, and that is a decision that the individual would have to make. Provident fund members, in terms of their vested interests, are not affected by the changes already made to the Act. So no one is being prejudiced about that. Mr. Chairman, the purpose, stated purpose of postponing the requirement to purchase an annuity for provident fund members for 2 years is to allow for more consultation. Now, the amendment that is proposed does not require a particular output. It simply requires consultation take place and reports come back. Cassandra have made their position and also this morning quite clear. Cassandra has stated, and I quote, Cassandra's position was and remains adamant that compulsory annuitization must be removed from the Act and the amendment law. Cassandra remains deeply opposed to compulsory annuitization. NILSA have expressed the same view. It is clear, therefore, that their postponement by 2 years is not supported in terms of the compulsory annuitization. Our view is that we won't die in the ditch for compulsory annuitization, but then the tax rates must not go to provident funds. Can't have them both ways. One of the most important issues facing South Africa today is policy uncertainty. And this is a microcosm of that policy uncertainty. We're now going to put this industry back into uncertainty for the next 2 years. It's symptomatic of the way we're doing business in South Africa today. We've had a lot to say about savings this morning, Mr. Chairman. Gross savings in the third quarter of 2015 amounted to 15.2% of GDP. But the household savings were only 0.2% of GDP. The fourth quarter, they have now dropped to 0.1% of GDP. This has dire consequences for poverty in old age. This in turn makes the elderly who are faced with poverty at a time when they should be entitled to a secure retirement very vulnerable to being exploited. Very vulnerable. National Treasury has emphasized that, and we agree. The Comprehensive Social Security Forum paper has been in abeyance for 10 years or more and must be progressed as swiftly as possible because it in itself leads to policy uncertainty. This reform, I think Momo echoes what I'm about to say, will not be a single event. It will take a considerable amount of time to be drafted, and implementation will of necessity be piecemeal.
The changes to the annuitization of provident fund benefits now enacted in the 2015 TRAA have started this process towards a comprehensive social reform and must not for now be reversed. Mr. Chairman, we propose an amendment to the bill as it stands, without that amendment, but, as it stands, that the clauses 1, 3, 4, and 5 be deleted, and one clause remain, which is a technical amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, the response is B. Treasury can reply.
Chair, if I may, for a moment. Chair, so I think we sort of understand the concern around providing the tax benefit to Provident Fund members, whereas postponing the amortization for the next 2 years. So we are trying to manage various interests and challenges there. If you take away both the benefit and the requirement to annuitize, effectively it means you are cutting out provident funds. Effectively it means for the industry, you will have to undo a significant portion of the upgrades you have done. And this is an issue we have tried to manage with the industry in terms of how can we make it less painful in terms of the changes we are proposing, in the sense that they don't have to go back and undo a lot of the systems they have done. So the 2 year postponement just on the annuitization is based on the realization that if it's just only on annuitization, then the system can be able to manage that postponement. You don't necessarily need to undo a lot of the upgrades you have done. But yes, the principle remains that in the absence of annuitizing, it becomes difficult to justify in the long term a tax benefit.
The problem is this, and if you go back to the media release that we put out, I think it was October 27. If you remember, we were offering two options. The one was to implement the reforms as we have it in the Act, and the other was a phased approach towards annuitization. And you'll notice in that I think this, I don't have it in front of me, but we recognize that the way we've changed the law, before there was an employer contribution and an employee contribution. The employer contribution was not taxable, so it was a non-taxable fringe benefit. So what it means is that Provident Fund members have been getting a tax deduction for the employer contribution. Okay. That is why when we say at the high end there was abuse, that people who want to structure all their contribution towards their retirement into a provident fund and make the employer be seen to be making the contribution. It's only where an employee makes his or her own contribution, and we find that with many workers, there's a case where the employee puts in 50 and they put in 50%. It may vary in percentage. Some will have maybe 100% or zero or whatever. But the employee contribution does not enjoy the tax deduction. So that's why when we looked at that phase approach, we said we've got to cap the deduction at this, what was it? 15 or?
We didn't say 15, we had a bunch of
15 and then going to basically zero, okay? If there was no annuitization, if I remember. Did it just remind me of?
I think we kept it. Okay. I agree with taking it away.
Yes. So I think that there are issues there like that will come up. So what I'm saying is, in effect, if there's no tax deduction, which from a principal's perspective certainly would be the logical way to go in the long term, but if you were to do that immediately, members of provident funds would actually take home significantly less, because the employer contribution
would then not enjoy a tax deduction. So I just thinking about the implications.
Yeah,
that's
why
we go to the October statement. It kind of had a phased approach because we thought it's unfair to remove it immediately.
Okay. Can I just raise a few things? I'm quite taken aback by it. Firstly, I don't understand what you're saying. Ever since 1998, with committees that I've chaired, because of legislative law, in case of local government and justice, we sat till 11 at night. We were exempted from the House. On this particular bill, the House chair from the NDOP side and the Speaker from the National Assembly side had said to us that when it comes to finance, we've got a blank check. I think probably justice would if it came to the bill. So you yourself served in subcommittees while I was sitting last year. Dears Van Rooy and Chair, G26. Last week, Thursday, we had public hearings. While the plenary was meant to sit, the decision to call off the plenary was made on Wednesday. Prior to that, nobody from the DA objected. The previous week, we sought an extension of an hour while Minister Gordhan spoke to us. Both houses were present committees. So this committee will never be able to do its work were we to sit on the sitting, normal sitting time. So it's something new now that no, when the plenary is sitting, you're not coming to committee meeting. Okay. You had your chance? If that's what you're saying, then you can't. Okay, right, fine. Okay, fine. So then the second thing is we've had a subcommittee system. Nothing stopped you from coming to these meetings. This is boring, actually. You are welcome to come. Now, Asifa would give you a meeting. So after this meeting, you come and say things that you feel you can't say in the public domain. We have a meeting. You should have said to me, you know, you must ask yourself, can you Google this? There is no country in the world that I know, I'm addressing both of you, or the three of you, where a committee in Parliament sits so the day before we vote on a bill and give you a chance. We ask them, give us inviting, after it's our third, last week's public hearing, we then turn to you and say, is there something between complete expungement and deferment? You give it to us. I read the document. We table the document. You won't get a chance anyway. You are not an ally.
Only in Mongolia.
You're not an ally of this ANC alliance. They are. But you have the same rights as stated. The reason we brought them in, right, is to actually knock them down. They haven't got what they wanted, fully. They actually wanted an expungement like Musa. So this is not a Kosovo bill in that sense. They didn't get complete expungement. Right? So since you feel very aggrieved, which you should have raised with me, I'm stunned, Rosemary, but you didn't say, Eunice, I want to be there too. So you want to come, we're going to cover the same ground again that we covered yesterday. So I remember, Charlie's not here, I will repeat everything we said. There's no conspiracy. Right? So we've done this many times. I have sat with your constituency, South African Agricultural Union, on the property rates bill. Right?
Not my constituency.
Yeah, your DA constituency. You know. Your Tony Leon even said to your member, how come this Communist Party leader of the ANC community is doing an agriculture group? This is in page 3, 10 years ago, right? Giving me, agreeing on the price. She won't be happy about that, right? She was in South Africa. So, why must we do it for the South African Agricultural Union on the property rates bill? Why must we do it for TAU on the property rates bill? Why must we do it for the private sector on the municipal systems bill, but we can't do it for COSATU? What's so special about all these other? So we will continue to do it. You show me where in the world it is wrong to take a specific and say, knock your heads together. So we will continue to do it until you show it's unconstitutional. That is the way public participation should be. Right? So now that you are apparently by him complaining, because he's sitting on your behalf. So let's have a meeting. After this meeting, I'm going to sit with you.
Mr. Chair, if I could just make a perception, Mr. Lee, so certainly I'm not speaking through Mr. Lee.
Fine.
I'm not agreed. We understand that there is an alliance, a political alliance, and we respect that. We understand that. I did not mean or have any intention to gate crash any meeting yesterday afternoon.
You could have come.
Had I been invited, I would have attended, but I respect the line. I respect that.
Yeah.
But I'm not agreed.
Oh, you want me to go to the
have that assurance.
Yeah, you see.
Give an assurance to this committee.
So you're not speaking for her?
Ms. Chairman?
And again, you know, Simon, you are very successfully twisting what I said. And I agree. I did not in any way suggest that the CISO were agreed.
So
I simply said that the amendment on the board was a product of negotiations between COSATU and National Treasury and some others.
So which
and the point that I'm making,
particular industry is not
do you really want me in the meeting or don't you? Because if you don't, then say so and I'll leave.
I'm not going to answer the question,
I've got the floor, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, the question, the point I put was that, and again you twisted my words, I did not say at any stage that COSATU should not be consulted with. Not once. I simply said that there are players in this game who came to the public hearings and who haven't been given the opportunity to comment. And whether we should or shouldn't or legally need to, I actually said to you, Mr. Chairman, I actually said to you that I had no idea whether it was legally a requirement or not, but ethically I thought we should. So, Mr. Chairman, you twist my words terribly, 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 and I object to that. I really do object to that.
Can you explain something simply? Which section of industry has been excluded? And who should be consulted? Which
organization? All right, let's go through them. BG Governmental Firm. Who's that? Andrew Crawford. And possibly others who were here.
They didn't offer verbal...
No, Mr. Chairman, I answered your question, and that's all I'm suggesting.
Parliament does not...
I'm not suggesting that we have to do it.
I'm just saying that... We
are
ready in submissions. Right. And there's no requirement on us to contact them to come again for public hearings. There's no such thing. It's never been done in this Parliament. We've gone far beyond what's required of us, and we now can't do more. So we've read their submissions. I read their submissions. What more do you want me to do? There's nothing there to finally look at them that's particularly distinctly different from the discourse we've had. So I don't think you should misrepresent what has been happening. And nobody's seeking deliberately. Now I see who he's talking about. So presumably you mean the people who made written submissions. You've been in Parliament long enough. Well, they never spoke. Did you stop anybody from... We didn't get any request for them to speak. They simply wrote to us.
I think you remember people seeking it up every day.
No. On this one, actually, everybody was written to. Some of them said they don't want to appear before the committee, but they will write to us. They might have come to observe. But hey, they don't require it. So you're just wrong if you're suggesting that. As you said, you want to have a meeting and cover the ground, we can report to you. But every subcommittee, really only with Casato or with other parties, we have to report, they can take any decisions. It just saves a lot of time. Now, from now on, I think you should come to every meeting. If you want to spend the time, I think others want to, you come to every meeting, it's fine. Right, so then, can we just say something else? That actually, on total 1, 3, 4, and 5, the effect of what you're saying has been covered in many, many ways from the beginning of the public hearings on this matter. I would like just to respond to the DA's proposals on amendments to the bill. Can we reply to that, please?
So are we not agreeing with what emerged earlier, what you're saying we want to do what the PA is?
Chair, I had thought we were finding each other, and I thought we should go ahead with yesterday's engagement and what has been brought to us here as a committee as sort of an outcome that tried to harmonize the challenges that were picked up when we did the last amendment. And from what Advocate Jenkins was saying, I think we should go with what Advocate was saying as well.
All right, so basically the compromise that emerged between Treasury and the unions agreed, at least one session, one federation, and as guided by the committee, based on inputs, is what we're going for, so we say no. If you look at the specific clauses, we'll take a few minutes. Advocate Jacobs has gone through it, we've discussed it,
So strictly speaking, we don't need more than 10 or 15 minutes. We say no to the proposal from the DA. That's what I understand. So now formally, just a minute, I think it is, now formally what happens is, tomorrow when we vote on the bill, must we actually get a written thing from it, says look, clause 1, 3, 4 and 5 to be deleted and so on, or do they, it's just done verbally? It's covered now. As far as I know, it's covered now and done with. But before we do, let my colleague speak, please.
No, Chair, I just wanted to stress the point that the intention of the committee is to, as much as possible, harmonize the relationships between amongst the key players, which is labor, business, and government. And I honestly don't think if there was anything wrong with having definite meetings with any partner who is saying, I would like more space, and I would like to make my input, and I would like to be heard. And I do think that we have to make it clear that any other stakeholder who wants to make an input is most welcome. And we should, in spite of these issues, because they actually, they have a very bad signal about who we are and what we are doing. I think in as much as possible, I think we need to avoid that. And I don't really see anything wrong. I do think that if Buddha had indicated to you that they wanted to make a submission and they probably need a meeting with you, Chairperson, I honestly do not think that you would have stopped them.
What would you have done? It would have to get visible.
Yeah.
The investor came to see me.
And it's in the normal sense with the money.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I report to you, look, there's a meeting, this is what happened. One stakeholder came to me and I said, no, you got such a vested interest in this problem, right? It is better, you're too technical for me. I'm a politician. Come and explain, come in the public hearing. So that's what he did. It happens all the time, actually. I mean, for such a, I hardly talk to you guys, I talk to you about politics. In fact, it's one of the least I've engaged with, actually. But the Refa is to sit for hours, let alone. So we will continue to do what Parliament requires of an active, public participation sensitive chair. And it's not going to change. We're not being credited, we're being lambasted here. You go and look up, Google it, and see where you'll ever get the opportunity you have here. So with you, Kusar. You both have the same opportunity. But I'm very happy to sit with you and summarize for you. You summarize it here, but I can teach you the whole thing. Again. What he said, was no secret.
Mr. Chair, I have no issue whatsoever. I'm actually quite distressed that you have a perception that I'm unhappy about any of the proceedings. I'm not unhappy. I was very
No, it's a clarified line. He's not talking about you. He's talking about Bowman. And you look at all that stuff.
And Mr. Chair, the report act that we received this morning as to the procedure and what the outcome of your meetings was satisfactory. I have no issue with
the situation. Okay, and I also thought here. Yeah, that's what I thought. Yeah.
You
okay. Yeah.
Ignore me.
No, she had a hand up. She had a hand up. Okay. Fine. Having said that, you were coming to say, sorry. Oh, yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, you see, once again, what I said has been completely misconstrued. I don't know whether it's deliberate or not. I can't talk in your head. But the fact is that I have said the consultation with Kosbashi at no stage did I say that it was inappropriate. At no stage did I say it was inappropriate. All I suggested and asked was it appropriate for us to call on others to consult with them? I didn't know whether it was legally possible, but I thought ethically it might be needed. You pointed out to me that, in fact, they haven't asked you to do it. Well, that might be a good enough reason. But for the record, there is no opposition to consulting with anyone in this meeting, outside the meeting, wherever it happens. If it's going to help the process, 100%. 100%. And please let that now be the record. And put members of the committee whom we have a long working relationship ahead of us. Please understand that I never said that and never implied that. In fact, I think I'm going to listen to the PMG record just to make sure that I didn't say something I didn't intend to say.
All right, let's move on. Can I just raise this issue now? Because we have to vote on this. Both the options are we prefer more than one party to be voting there, even if they come to say they're opposed. So if there's no agreement that we need tomorrow, we'll agree on Friday at 10 o'clock because we have to vote on this bill this week. So I would like to engage outside this meeting with the opposition parties to find a suitable time, because it's the House that will be able to debate these things. The parties that are opposing it will oppose it anyway. So I'm suggesting that we can't get agreement on meeting tomorrow. I'll seek to ensure that we meet on Friday at 10 o'clock to vote on the bill. And I really regret that people's constituency and other work will be impeded, but what can we do? All right, over to you, Alf.
Just to put the record straight again, at no stage did I say that meeting during a deanery was unacceptable. I simply said tomorrow is precedence questions, and I didn't know whether I could make it or not. And certainly before that, I have an engagement. I mean, there's a long-standing engagement, and if you really want to know...
You're not opposed in principle.
Absolutely not.
In which case, we can try to meet just after 12 o'clock. I'll discuss our third meeting. It depends on when the caucus is finished. Because I don't think caucus people, chief of seven, allow people to leave before the caucus is sitting. So can we go for a few minutes after this meeting, and we'll set a time and Helen will send a note to start. Good, thank you very much. Anybody else from this?
Just as you say, I do agree. I think that's the best way we can try and set up the time. As you stated, this is the meeting we sit down and talk. But just as in case, you can just take us back just a little bit. Out of the lead chapters and people that give submissions, we are aware that there are certain people who will say to you they would like to make written submissions. And I think probably that is the list which my colleague here has got. But then Jefferson, let's open up again, you know, other people as well who may want to come in. But I think most of what we will receive from the Jefferson are people that say they would just like to make oral submissions so that we get an understanding of who actually said they need to make oral submissions, and then probably make time for more people to consult with. But definitely we can meet after this meeting to set up a time when we can discuss, as you have stated.
I'm just saying that we have had a hearing. The written submissions we have read, presumably all of us, I don't think we read them, we asked Jotani to read them, pick up, is there anything in any of these submissions that are not covered by the discussions we've had? It will not be possible to have public hearings again tomorrow, so there's nothing more we can do. I know that the NCOP spoke about possibly having public hearings on that side. I don't think it's still going without having public hearings. We're not sure. But the NCOP is sitting there, and people can request to go to the NCOP side and make representations if they want. But I imagine that the people who really want to make oral submissions were the ones that appeared before the committee last week. Momo?
I know this is none of my business, but I was just going to ask, is it possible to go through, even if you don't finalize the bill, the clause by clause, because in a sense, if there are issues, we just like to know.
Okay, fine. We can do that quickly. I don't think we'll do it tomorrow, but you're right. In case something comes up at the last moment.
As I remember it, we were taken through the bill, right? At that stage, we had asked Advocate Jacob, because the bill only had one issue. The rest of it is purely technical. So it's not like going to the Financial Sector Regulation Bill or the African Bank Bill. So I thought we were just pretty straightforward. But all right, there may be things. So we're looking at clause one. We're seeking it informally. Is there anything beyond what Advocate Jenkins said last time? You want to say this, right?
Not sure.
No, right. So on clause one, is there anything you want to pick up?
You want to make a change there?
No. I want Chris to come in, so the other goals that we wanted to know exactly where the change will be back to.
Well, we'd like to send the text out by this evening, please. So the men look at it before they come to the committee tomorrow.
So we'll give it to Christine and Howell.
Yeah, I'll
give it now.
Well, okay, fine, then we can give it to Alan to send it out now. The report I'll have to look at tonight.
Yes,
and
I.
Yeah.
So
as
you can see, I mean, this is... The clause one is the provision for immunitization which I'll postpone. We went through in the previous public hearing that it's all being replaced, and we needed to do that to replace the dates in lines 44, 47, etc. The change to the bill, the proposed change to the bill, was that the first clause deals with all the immunitization for all different retirement funds, and then Advocate Jenkins, this is, can you just check that with me? But we were thinking of, if you look at the board, there's number two here, subsection one comes into operation on 1 March 2018, and then we would from there have a three. And three would refer to the wording we said. So that's the Minister of Finance will deliberate interested parties in respect of the manner and implementation of subsection one. The subsection one would be part of clause one and would be the utilization referring to that, if that is okay with the committee. And then, again, the deliberation contemplated in A to include deliberation and NEDLAC. And the
Minister of Finance. Did you want to cover this?
I mean, we've covered this. So I don't have any other questions on one. We can move on.
So only a manager should have it.
Yeah, okay, right. Is there anybody who doesn't understand that?
No, okay.
Right. Then the next one, please.
Okay, so clause two, as previously mentioned, was the technical error with
the
introduction. Okay, that's fine. And clause three was on the deletion of the previous immutilization requirement and the postponement of all the other sections related to transfers, compulsory annuities, etc. And the advocate Jenkins, he just did that. I think we would now, because you mentioned earlier we were trying to replace C, but now by putting the provision into one, we can actually keep C, but we would still delete the 2-year review. Okay. So that's fine on clause three. On clause four, this is in relation to transfers again, so it's postponement of the transfers. And on clause five, 1 and 3. I think this is also part of transfers, but again, it's just a delay. Yeah, it's just a delay to those ones. So the other clauses are all just for the delays. So they are at least.
Okay. On the last 3, 4, 5, any comments?
No.
Good. So basically, informally, we process the bulk. So we formal tomorrow. But I really would urge members to please check, right, because it could be a technical issue. So, can we send this out by 2, could be a mistake. What's the time now? It's 12:20. Can you do it by 2? Yeah, it's done, yeah. So, can we send out by this afternoon, 3 o'clock, very late, right?
Okay.
And the report I'll send out to you guys tonight. Yeah, please, yeah. Okay, 3 p.m. is the cutoff point, that would be. Or soon after that.
That would be soon.
Yeah, good. Thank you very much. Is anything else?
No.
Can I just speak to Formula and ask to see where we can agree on the time?
Yes.
Yeah.
So what we're going to have to do, just to be clear, we have to conform to section 11.5 as the Jenkins. So
yeah, normal procedure.
Remember there's those 5
sections. Yeah, we have to bring
that in. So we'll have to bring all of those reports when you
that's
finally consider the budget.
Yeah, but what we would like is for you to get that available as soon as possible.
Yeah, actually it will take us, we will try and do it before 5 a.m.
Yeah, because not that comprehensive.
No.
Yeah.
No.
Okay. I mean, we have to do this every now and then, because I mean, every time it changes,
yes,
okay.
Yes.
There's Parliament to write to, so we survive by the rules. Thanks. That's fine.
How do you